Well, greetings, everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Zatar, I'd like to welcome you to the first teleclass of the 2006 teleclass series. Now, this is going to be a really outstanding year for teleclass education. It will feature more English language teleclasses than ever before, that through our series based out of New York and out of London, and in our new teleclass series based out of Australia. We have also several French teleclasses this planned for this year, as well as a new teleclass series in Spanish. And also at the request of the Chinese government, we expect that a Chinese language teleclass series will be launched later this year as well. It's all very exciting for me, and it's all thanks to you folk who continue to support this program and to the volunteers who make it happen. Thank you very much. Our teleclass today is Healthcare-Acquired Infection as an Indicator of Patient Safety with Dr. Elaine Larson of Columbia University in New York. Dr. Larson holds more titles and offices, many more than I can enumerate here. I will say that she is world-renowned for her research in infection control, particularly as it has to do with hand hygiene, but she's also probably one of the most prolific researchers in a variety of other aspects of infection prevention and control, and it's a real honor to have her with us. She is an ideal teleclass faculty member. Dr. Larson first gave a teleclass in 2003. She also launched our 2004 and 2005 schedules, and I'm really glad to have her back here as our lead-off batter again this year. To give the teleclass, Healthcare-Acquired Infections as an Indicator of Patient Safety, from Columbia University in New York City, it is my privilege to present Dr. Elaine Larson. Elaine.
Thank you, Paul. And you'll notice that there are many authors on the presentation that I'm going to give today, so they're on your first slide. I heard one of you when you were joining say that you were just starting a program in hand hygiene, and let me hasten to say that this talk is not on hand hygiene, but hopefully it will still be, maybe there'll be something to glean from it. What we're going to do today, if you look at the second slide, we have a list of objectives. We're going to discuss the patient safety movement a little bit. Most of you, all of you have heard of it, and I just want to emphasize the fact that infection prevention and control has been working in patient safety for decades, and some of the words are changing, some of the organizations that are involved are changing, but basically it's the same bottom line that we've had for a long time. I want to talk a little bit about two specific sources of threats to patient safety, one of which is related to staffing, and the mounting evidence that there is a correlation between increased risk of infections, certain types of healthcare-associated infections, and nurse staffing. And then I also did want to give you some data on the role of hospital organizational climate on nurse turnover, because nurse staffing and nurse turnover are very, very related. So you may wonder why in the world we're talking not about infection specifically, but about turnover, and that is because I think there is evidence, again, that nursing turnover and poor hospital organization does increase the risk of safety problems and adverse events among patients, specifically healthcare-associated infections. In the middle, I'm just going to put in a little bit of a commercial about institutional review boards, because there's a lot of confusion, I think, both in the research and the practice communities about when should I go to an IRB, are they going to slow me up, is it a pain, how do I facilitate my interactions with the IRB. And I want to talk about that a little bit, partly because I'm the chair of one of the IRBs at Columbia, and see both from the researcher and the practitioner perspective, but also from the regulatory perspective, why this is all pretty important. So that's what we're going to do in the next 50 minutes or so, and then we'll try to leave a little bit of room at the end for discussion. The next slide just to review again the patient safety problem and the fact that the Institute of Medicine, in a report a few years ago, really brought the whole issue to the front page of the New York Times and all around the world, the fact that as many deaths occur in hospitals and in healthcare institutions from adverse events and errors as they do from many other things. There is just a couple of other reports that have come out since then. Another IOM report, Crossing the Quality Chasm, which was a follow-up to the first one, and a blueprint on how to modify our healthcare system to try to make it safer. And then another report from the IOM, Keeping Patients Safe, Transforming the Work Environment of Nurses. The next slide just talks about the fact that some definitional things that I think are probably important. One is, and what's the difference between an error and an adverse event? An error is a failure of planned action to be completed as intended, or the use of the wrong plan to achieve an aim, whereas an adverse event is an actual injury that can occur from an error in the healthcare setting. Not all errors, happily, luckily, result in adverse events, and not all adverse events are the result of a medical error. So on the next slide, just a couple of examples of the difference between an adverse event and a medical error. In the first row is an example of a patient with a ruptured appendix who developed sepsis. Now, obviously, that's an adverse event. It's a terrible thing that happens to a patient. It's probably, however, not preventable. It's not a medical error, so it's not a patient safety problem in the classic sense. The second example is a patient who doesn't receive an antibiotic on time, or any drug on time. The patient may not have a side effect from that, and if they don't, it's not an adverse event. However, it is a medical error, and it is preventable. Then the third example is patient experience with a device-related, that the patient gets a device-related healthcare-associated infection. That is an adverse event. It is also a medical error because it relates to a device that was inserted or implanted during a hospital stay. The final example is a patient who dies as a result of the infection, of an infection. It could be an adverse event if it's the result of a medical error, or it may just be the result of host factors in the patient. So it may or may not be preventable, it may or may not be an adverse event. So on the next slide, just some more definitional things. A sentinel event is a word that's used frequently by the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations and other groups. Talks about an adverse event that results in death or very serious injury. Usually sentinel events are quite rare, and they're very serious. So those obviously we want to prevent all the time. Near misses is some process variation or error that does not affect the outcome, but for which recurrence carries risk of serious adverse outcomes. For example, not giving the right drug, medication errors, etc. Those are things we want to prevent and identify so that we can figure out how to make sure they happen with less frequency. Active failures are unsafe acts committed by individuals, in this case, healthcare providers. And latent failures are failures that arise from fallible decisions made by people indirectly involved, such as poor staffing, etc. Next slide, the Joint Commission in 2004 published 7 national patient safety goals, one of which is to reduce the risk of healthcare-associated infections. And two of the priority areas that they have identified to reduce the risks is to comply with the current CDC hand hygiene guideline and to manage as sentinel events identified cases of unanticipated death or major permanent loss of function associated with infections. So our accrediting bodies are focusing on these two areas. And I can tell you now that the Joint Commission is helping to work on ways to, for example, monitor compliance with hand hygiene, because the CDC guideline asks us to have a plan for monitoring compliance to see how effective the guideline and the implementation of the guideline is. One of the big challenges for practitioners is, well, okay, we're supposed to monitor hand hygiene, but how in the world are we supposed to do that? Because it's very cost effective. If you have observers, it changes people's behavior. So the Joint Commission is very interested in helping clinicians find the best ways to monitor and assess hand hygiene behavior. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality Patient Safety Indicators focus on adverse events following surgery, procedures, and childbirth. These patient safety indicators were developed after comprehensive literature review, expert panel review, etc. And I've given you here the website where you can actually download their software to look at the patient safety indicators. On the next slide, it just describes the fact that there are 20 hospital-level patient safety indicators, such as birth trauma, accidental punctures, etc. And four of these patient safety indicators have been identified as staffing sensitive. That is, they have an impact. The staffing patterns in the hospital can have an impact on the patient's risk for these four patient safety indicators. The next slide, then, for infection control and patient safety, what is the link? Well, as you know, infection control has been in the business of doing surveillance and defining infections and looking at standardized ways of measuring things since the 1970s. So the patient safety issue is not a new one, and infection control brings a huge body of expertise to this whole area. Next slide. Some of the goals of the patient safety movement are to identify sources of threats to patient safety, including leadership and management issues, workforce issues, work process issues. Are there ways that we can develop work processes and systems in the work setting to reduce the risk of making a mistake? And then organizational culture. I want to talk for a minute about organizational and safety culture, because there has been there is a body of research to show that you can create in any healthcare setting a climate or a culture that either enhances or reduces the potential that you're going to give safe patient care. So what are the things that have been shown to be predictive of a safe culture in a healthcare setting? First of all, it's an integrated pattern of individual and organizational behavior based on shared beliefs and values in the setting that continuously seeks to minimize patient harm, which may result from the processes of care delivery. So a safety culture must have explicit, specific, short and long-term safety objectives that everybody who works there knows about and can articulate. There must be ways to review and provide feedback on success or failure at meeting these objectives. And this is kind of the reason why we're trying to get away from the blaming kind of a culture where reporting an adverse event is a punitive activity, to one where it's an effort for continuous improvement. And then there needs to be, in the safety culture, training and rewards for workers for safety. These are some of the things that have been shown to be predictive of environments where patient safety is improved. The next slide talks a little bit more about the organizational elements of a safety climate, and that is environmental structures and processes within the organization which focus on safety, again, that the workers share the attitude and the perception that we're in the business of providing safe care, and that safety-related behaviors of individuals are enhanced. Next slide work process and workspaces need to be designed to make them efficient, less conducive to the commission of errors, and more amenable to detecting errors. There are ways to set up the environment and the culture so that it's not easy to screw up, that it's easy to do the right thing. And obviously there is a whole body of research that shows that fatigue can slow reaction time, it can result in lapses in attention, in compromised problem solving, etc. More work process issues on the next slide. We need to design work areas and processes to reduce errors associated with surveillance, with transfers and handoffs, that is, during report time, during time when change of shift or change of staff. And those are times when there's a much higher risk of patients falling out of bed, medication errors, etc. And then to look at non-value-added activities that we often are required to do because there's nobody else to do them. Looking for things, finding where they are, looking for other people, finding out a way to get a hold of somebody, trying to get them on the telephone, documenting things in several places, and poor communication systems. So the first areas of it to address that have been identified by many organizations are medication administration and hand hygiene. So designing the work area should certainly reflect an understanding of human factors such as memory, fatigue, ergonomics, should be standardized, should facilitate immediate access to information, should be created with the most vulnerable people in mind, and should have the capability of changing. Now, how do you actually go about this? This kind of workplace design has to be done at the leadership level, and it's very important that infection prevention is at the table at the leadership and management level. So in terms of leadership and management on the next slide, to provide ongoing vigilance and balancing efficiency and patient safety, always cognizant of costs and cost benefit, demonstrating and promoting trust in the staff, engaging staff in decision making and work design, and establishing the organization as a learning climate. So job redesign and performance on the next slide, let me just go through these bullets with you. Job redesign leads to improved job perceptions and satisfaction. It may lead to increased motivation because of pay raises or improved promotion prospects. That is, workers feel that they are, when they are involved, they're motivated and they're more likely to perform better. Performance may improve if workers perceive closer links between what they do, what they're trying to do, and what they're rewarded for and what's valued in the organization. Job redesign may be accompanied by goal setting. Employees either set for themselves new performance targets or management sets those targets. And there's a lot of evidence that goal setting is a very powerful motivator, in particular under specific conditions such as difficult goals. So it's extremely helpful to involve staff in the design and the redesign of their own jobs so that they actually own what's going on. And redesigning a job, one discovers inefficiencies such as inadequate access to equipment or space issues, etc., that may be overcome without costly changes, but by work method improvements and that kind of thing. So I wanted to just move now. The first point here I wanted to make is that involving staff at all levels in designing the workplace, the work setting, and the processes of work to enhance safety has been shown to be extremely effective. Time-consuming, yes. Involving more people, yes. And sometimes frustrating, but ultimately the outcomes are greatly improved. I want to move now to talk a little bit about the way that institutional review boards protect or fail to protect patient safety, and specifically in terms of research and projects that you might be thinking about or doing as you move in your work design and your patient safety efforts. In the next slide, I just want to summarize for you how much human research is being done in the U.S. I can't speak for other countries, but still, it's a huge enterprise. So 6 years ago, there were an estimated 12 million people participating in federally funded research alone. That's not even counting industry-funded research, with millions more participating in other kinds of studies. There are a number of national, federal agencies and regional agencies to protect people, but the Office of Human Research Protection, OHRP, is responsible for monitoring compliance of greater than 30,000 NIH-funded studies. Next slide. I know that many of you are not necessarily involved in research, so why am I talking about this? Well, the reason I'm talking about it is because as the years go on, the line between quality improvement, quality assurance, and research is getting finer and finer, so that many of the things that we're involved in, projects to improve the work setting, to improve patient safety, quality assurance projects, are really, could very easily be researched. They could be publishable. And so when is it that you, what is this fine line and how do you decide? Well, I would say that some general guidelines are that if you're doing projects and you're thinking about the possibility of publishing the results or disseminating the results beyond your own healthcare setting, then you need to probably think about getting IRB approval before you start, even if it's just a chart review, because more and more journals are asking for evidence that you've gotten approval from some kind of an ethics board or an institutional review board before you start. Obviously, whenever patients are identifiable in any way, then you need to think about an IRB. And if you're interested in generalizing the results that you're finding in your setting beyond your own setting, which I hope you are, because so much good work is being done out there, and unless we disseminate it and communicate it with each other, we're not really taking full advantage of learning from each other. So these are some general criteria that I would use, and if this is happening, then you need to think about interfacing with your IRB. So in the next slide, these are just the three basic ethical principles of research. First of all, beneficence, meaning that we do not want to do harm, that there is no study, and in fact, few projects that we do, even clinical projects, that are completely free of risk. You give an aspirin, and there's some risk. So there's risk in everything that we do, whether it's therapeutic or research. But the risk-benefit ratio must be in favor of the potential for finding out something that is going to be better for patients. So the second ethical principle is respect for persons, that we maintain their confidentiality, that they are allowed to give voluntary consent to participate in projects, and if they choose not to, that's their right, and that they fully understand what it is, what project it is that you're doing. I'll give you an example of something that 5 years ago would have been considered quality assurance and now might be considered research. We just recently published a paper looking at the difference in the microbiology of the skin between a traditional bed bath and the new disposable kinds of bed baths that are available on the market. And we were interested in whether the traditional basin bed bath versus the marketed kind made any difference in the cleanliness of the skin of the patients and also in their satisfaction with the bath and how much time it took. Well, you know, a few years ago we might have just done that in the hospital and said, well, we like this one better than that one. But we did do it as a, we knew we wanted to publish it because this was information that people were asking us all the time. So we went through an IRB and the paper is now published. That's an example. Anyway, the third ethical principle for research is that it must be fair, and there must be equal opportunity for people to have an opportunity to be involved in a project if they want to. And also, because many times we may leave out people because they don't speak English, or they don't have a telephone, or because we pick people to be involved in a project that are easier to talk to, or so forth. And that is not just and fair. So those are the three ethical principles. On the next slide, just to review, I know you all know the role of an institutional review board is to protect patient safety. That's its primary role, only in research, not in other things that aren't research, and to assure that the benefits either to the individual or to society outweigh the risks, to prevent coercion to participate among people, and to assure that the appropriate mechanisms are in place so that patients do give, it might not even be patients, it might be nurses or doctors or others who are the participants in a project, but to assure that they are voluntarily participating. So what does the infection control professional need, when do they need the IRB? Again, a fine line between quality monitoring, surveillance, and research. But if you're planning to publish your results, or if the data collection is not solely for patient care but is also for wider dissemination, then you need to interface with the IRB. Real briefly on the next slide, I wanted to give you the three levels of review and approval that an IRB can determine. The first level is an exempt protocol, and that is for projects related to educational testing, for projects that are using data already collected. For example, a chart review, if you want to do a chart review on the risk of catheter-associated bloodstream infection following a new type of catheter, or if you want to observe hand hygiene in your staff on the units, as long as the data are de-identified, that is anonymous so that nobody can tell who the subject is, that can be rated by the IRB as exempt. Now, you can't decide for yourself whether it's exempt. The IRB has to do that, and they will then say this has been determined to be exempt. But it still needs to be looked at by an IRB. The next level is expedited review and approval. That means that it does not have to go to a full board. It can be determined actually by the chair of the IRB or by an individual reviewer. And that is for the kinds of projects that you're likely to do, data collected by non-invasive means like focus groups, minor changes in previously approved projects, or it can even be for projects where there's, for example, obtaining one blood sample or one test, that kind of thing. But it can't be for things that involve taking x-rays and so forth. Then the final level of review is the full board review, and that's any time there's an intervention where patients are randomized to one drug or one treatment versus the other, anything where there are drugs involved, etc., or if you're randomizing patients to receive one type of IV catheter or one type of urinary catheter versus another, that would be a full board review. And IRB boards are comprised usually of about a dozen people with a variety of different expertise. Now, I just, on the next slide, wanted to talk to you about a survey that we did last year. It's published in the literature if you're interested in it, but we were doing a project in 68 hospitals in the U.S. This was a project of Dr. Pat Stone's to examine the relationship between organizational climate, staffing, and infections. I'm going to show you the results of that project in a minute. But we had to go through the IRBs of 68 hospitals. So we had a lot of experience going through institutional review boards, and this is just a summary of the differences in the boards. The next slide, in this of the 68 hospitals, the majority were from the East Coast. You can see the mean bed size was 465, and a small minority of the hospitals were associated with academic health centers. The next slide, what we found is that the mean number of pages for the application was 5, but it varied from hospital to hospital for the identical study from 1 page to 31 pages. 1 to 8 copies of the protocol were requested by the hospitals. About 1/3 of the hospitals required that the principal investigator be on site. So since Dr. Stone was not on site, we had to find someone at each hospital, and we really appreciated the hospitals who participated, who would agree to be the investigator at that site. Surprisingly, only about 1/4 of the hospitals required any training, research training, and ethics training, evidence of that from the investigators, and only 10% asked us whether we had any conflicts of interest. For example, if we were doing a study on an IV catheter and the study was funded by the maker of the IV catheter, it would be important for the hospital to know about that because that's a potential conflict of interest. But not very many hospitals asked us. And then 2 of the 68 hospitals had no institutional review board. The mean time to approval on the next slide was 45 days, but you can see that it varied tremendously from 1 day to 303 days, or almost a year, to get approval to do this study. And there was a wide variation in the boards. 20% of them called the study exempt, 60% had it expedited, and 17% a full review. So clearly, kind of what this says to me is that there's a big need for standardization across IRBs on the next slide. And we really had to question whether the goal of protecting research participants was met very effectively when there were such wide variations. So this would be kind of like defining infections without any definitions. So the IRBs have a long way to go. Nevertheless, don't get frustrated. Do make friends with your IRB, and do think about when there might be times when they could even be helpful to you in terms of the rules and so forth. So on the next slide, the implications for infection control professionals is that there definitely is increased scrutiny of even your routine surveillance activities and data collection, certainly at the national, at the federal level. And you will need to know what your process for IRB is. And consider in some of your daily routine surveillance things how you could expand that to add to the body of generalizable infection control knowledge, not just what it will do for your own place. Now, the next slide, I want to change again the topic to talk a little bit about the evidence for an association between nurse staffing and healthcare-associated infections. So the next slide, this is really just a summary of the review of the literature, and these are the kinds of infections that have been linked with staffing. On the next slide, I'm going to start going through some of the literature, and we have put on each slide the reference for you in case you want to follow these up. This study, the first study, looked at the relationship between the number of float nurses, that is, nurses who are temporary going from unit to unit, and bloodstream infection. It was a study in 8 intensive care units, and the results were that there was a significant increase in bloodstream infections when the central venous catheter care was done by a float nurse, which I guess isn't too surprising because central venous catheter care, bloodstream infections may well be related to the catheter care. And if a nurse is less trained or less familiar with the unit's technique, that makes sense. Next slide, looked again at pooled nurses, which are hired nurses from temporary pools. And this was a case control study in a 20-bed surgical ICU in a large hospital. And they looked at 28 patients and 99 controls. What they found in this study is that bloodstream infections were significantly increased when care was given by nurses from the temporary pool, similar to the previous study. This next study on the next slide looked at the patient-to-nurse ratio and impact on bloodstream infection. This was, again, a couple of studies, case control and cohort studies in a surgical ICU and in regular wards. And what they found is that the patient-to-nurse ratio was higher during an outbreak, significantly higher, and that the surgical ICU bloodstream infection correlated with the patient-to-nurse ratio. So in both cases, when there were fewer nurses to numbers of patients, there were significant increases. There was an increase in the risk of an outbreak and increase in the risk of bloodstream infection. The next slide looked at the number of registered nurse hours and the risk of pneumonia. This was a national study done by with American Hospital Association data, and they found a significant inverse relationship between RN hours per adjusted patient day and pneumonia, so that when the registered nurse hours were lower, there was a significantly higher risk of pneumonia. Next slide, again, looked at the nurse-to-patient ratio and pneumonia. This was a statewide cohort study in Maryland. The results were that the nurse-to-patient ratio of less than 1 to 2 was associated with a doubling of the risk of pneumonia. And this was, I believe this was for a specific diagnosis. As you can see, esophageal resection. Next slide looked at pneumonia and urinary tract infection in 589 hospitals in 10 states. And this study showed an inverse relationship between full-time nurse hours and the risk of pneumonia and urinary tract infection. Next, for the proportion of RN hours, again, a higher proportion of RN hours was associated with lower rates of urinary tract infection and pneumonia, and a higher proportion of RN hours with lower rates of urinary tract infection in the surgical unit as well as in the medical unit. You can, again, have a look at these studies, and there are a number that have come out very, very recently as well. Next, this was in the ANA report card, finding that low RN skill mix was associated with pneumonia and urinary tract infection. Again, very consistent results. And then the next slide, again, showing low RN skill mix associated with pneumonia and UTI. Okay, next slide, the patient-to-nurse ratio and GI infections in a general pediatric unit. On this unit, they found a correlation between the rate of infection and patient-to-nurse ratio days, on the day shift, the night shift, and the total census. Next, showed an inverse correlation between infection rates during an outbreak and the ratio of nursing hours per patient day. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on any of these because they're a little bit repetitive, but what I want you to see here, which is a criterion that we always use for when results are worth taking seriously, and that is that these are fairly consistent results across a number of studies, a number of years, different settings, different study designs. That is a sign that there is something real going on here. This next one, Dr. Harbarth's study, and this was, I believe this was in Geneva, looking at understaffing an outbreak of Enterobacter cloacae, once again showing a very high relative risk of infection when the staffing was insufficient. And next, extra staph and an outbreak of methicillin-resistant staph, what they found is that before and during an outbreak, only 50% of the staff were full-time nurses. Many of them were, 42% of the nurses were relatively untrained, and that there seemed to be an association between hiring outside staff and having untrained staff and the outbreak. Next, the study by Vicka, nurse-patient ratios at MRSA, again a correlation between MRSA and the ratios of staff to patient, peak staff to patient, trough staff to patient, and nurse to patient ratios were all significant. So just to give you a summary on the next slide of the research linking nurse staffing and infection rates. The strengths are that there's a very high reproducibility. There's a lot of findings that are showing this. There's a big body of knowledge now. And the weaknesses on the next slide are that most of these studies are outbreak investigations, retrospective studies. There are very few prospective studies. There are a couple that have large data sets, and some of those data sets aren't very good, like the studies done with the AHA data set. They aren't designed to look at this, so there are some weaknesses inherent in the data sets. And then there are huge variations, as you saw, in the definition of what the staffing across studies. So those are some of the weaknesses of the database. Next slide. I want to talk to you about a study that we just finished. The main author of this study is Dr. Simiati, and this study will be published soon. It's not published yet, so you're seeing it before it gets published. This was an actual prospective study. It's one of the first prospective studies in a neonatal ICU that included all nursing staff providing patient care to the neonates and all neonates admitted to two units over a period of 2 years. The outcomes that we looked at were the time to first infection for any healthcare-associated infection, bloodstream infection, conjunctivitis. We also looked at length of stay and the impact of staffing. So the predictor variables that we looked at were birth weight, major surgery, hand hygiene product used, whether it was alcohol or chlorhexidine and gluconate in the unit, and then which NICU the babies were in. The staffing variables that we looked at were the total nursing hours, that is all staff who provided direct nursing care, whether it was an RN or a patient care tech, etc. Then we looked at registered nurse hours, the number of hours of RN care. We looked at the number of hours of care provided by floats and agency nurses. And then we looked at the skill mix, that is the proportion of registered nurses to other nursing or direct care providers. We adjusted in all of our analyses for DRGs. We also adjusted for nursing intensity weights, which is a statistic that is used by New York State to predict the care needs of neonates based on how sick they are. So we adjusted by severity of illness. We also adjusted, as I mentioned, by birth weight, by whether or not a neonate had had surgery, and a couple of other things. So here's our results. It was a little over 3,000 neonates that we studied. Well, the final sample was 2,600 because we excluded those who were in the hospital for less than 48 hours. Of those, 374 neonates got an infection, and 114 of those had more than one infection. Here on the next slide are just a real brief summary of our results. But what we found is that healthcare-associated infections were associated with low nurse RN hours. The hazard ratio, or the relative risk, was 1.75. Going clockwise, the length of stay was shorter when there was a high skill mix, that is, when there were more registered nurses as compared with other nursing staff. Bloodstream infections were associated with higher risk with low total nursing hours, low RN hours, and high numbers of pooled staff from outside. So there were high relative risks for bloodstream infection with those variables. And for conjunctivitis, there was a longer time to development of conjunctivitis when the total nursing hours were higher. So that was higher nursing hours was protective of the neonates getting conjunctivitis. Okay, so that's kind of the results there, but you will see coming out the results of that, at least in terms of the bloodstream infections and the risk. Just wanted to briefly review now another study. The PI was Pat Stone, and this is a study to look at the relationship between intensive care unit working conditions and turnover among nurses. The reason this is important is because we've just shown you that experienced, skilled nurses who work in a unit for a long time and an appropriate mix of nurses is important for reducing the risk of infection. So we want to reduce the turnover. So the next slide, the working conditions and patient safety, we've already gone over this. There's concern about poor working conditions, then that might be contributing to decreasing patient safety. There's also a rather acute nursing shortage right now, particularly in certain areas like ICU. But this current shortage is particularly important because of the aging workforce. The average age of nurses now is in the mid-40s. 10 years ago, it used to be in the 30s, so that's a concern. Next slide, the purpose was to examine the factors related to intention to leave among nurses. Next slide, the design was a cross-sectional survey, and we asked people to do an anonymous survey in the 68 hospitals where we're doing the study. Next slide, we measured organizational climate, we asked some demographic questions, and we asked about their intention to leave their job. The question was, do you intend to leave your position in the coming year? And if they said yes, we asked why. Next slide, we got a little over 2,000 responses in 109 ICUs. Some of the hospitals had several ICUs. That's why we had more than 68. Next slide, you can see that 89% of the respondents were female, and 57% had a baccalaureate or higher degree. Most of them were full-time. Next slide. The average age in this group was 39. The average age of nurses in intensive care units is younger than the average age of nurses. And they were fairly experienced. Their years of experience was about 15 on average. Next slide is the hospital characteristics, just where they were located and their size. And then the next slide is that 17% of the nurses said that they intended to leave their job within the next year. And of those, 72% said that it was because of negative working conditions. Next slide, we did not find any difference in intention to leave related to their demographics, that is their age, their location, or other hospital characteristics like bed size, etc. Next slide, these are the organizational climate factors that were significantly related to their intention to leave. The odds ratios that are below one were actually protective factors, and the ones that are above one were factors that were harmful. So what you see here is the important ones are the three with the asterisks. These three factors were found to be significantly protective, that is, where there was a participatory governance in the unit, nurses were significantly less likely to be intending to leave. Where there was a supervisor that showed interest and was active and involved, and where there was on-the-job training where the nurses felt that they got the kind of education they needed, those were the three significantly protective factors for organizational climate. Next slide. The summary is that behavioral intention to leave across the nation is fairly high. Even in this experienced group, 17% said they plan to leave in the next year. Negative perceptions of organizational climate did have an impact on their intention to leave. and the perception of their participation in their governance, positive leadership skills of their supervisors, and support for RN training were independent protective factors for intention to leave. The next slide, the turnover of one RN is estimated to cost somewhere between $30,000 and $50,000, and it's most expensive among critical care nurses. So the implications on the next slide is that it's important to invest in the nurse staffing, which may ultimately actually save money. Next slide lists the limitations, and the next slide lists the implications for infection control. I just want to go to the next slide, which is the predictors of healthcare-associated infections, and show you, you can see what were significant predictors of infections in this big study. Most of the things were things we can't do much about, such as gender, age of the patient, history of cardiovascular disease, socioeconomic status. But the two at the bottom in yellow, the proportion of registered nurse overtime was significantly predictive of healthcare-associated infections. So that in hospitals where there was high nurse overtime, they had a 2 times greater risk of infections in their ICUs than the hospitals without overtime. And where the organizational climate was better, that was protective for healthcare-associated infections. So in summary, the more positive the organizational climate, the less likely the patient will acquire a healthcare-associated infection. The higher the proportion of overtime, the more likely the patient will acquire overtime. And final thoughts, healthcare-associated infections are a major patient safety problem. More can be done at the organizational and the unit level, not just at the individual level, to help prevent these infections by assuring appropriate staffing, providing opportunity for staff input, and doing good surveillance of outcomes so that we actually can measure when our efforts make a difference. So infection control staff really must work at the top levels of the organization to get these things moving along. So I'll stop there and open up for a couple of questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Larson, for a very clear, very interesting, and really wide-ranging teleclass. It really highlights that infection control is so integrated with so many other different aspects of what goes on in the hospital. If you don't mind me asking, is there criteria to be a part of the membership of an IRB? Who selects who joins those groups?
The IRBs?
Yeah.
There are certain rules, like there always has to be a layperson, at least one layperson. That's somebody from the community who doesn't work in the institution, and they're there to represent sort of from the patient perspective. That layperson is very, very helpful because they can look at consent forms and say, look, guys, this doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know what you're talking about. So they're very helpful. There has to be a variety of expertise, so that often there's, you know, surgery or neurology or ethics, et cetera. There aren't too many other criteria, except that it needs to be someone who knows the rules and or can learn the rules and who does enough, is involved enough in the research to have an appreciation for the risk-benefit ratio and design issues.
My question for Dr. Larson is, all that discussion and publication about screening patients for MRSA and so on, is this something that should be taken to the IRB board, even though you may not plan on publishing?
No. If you're just screening people for the purposes of, you know, deciding how to take care of them, that's not really research. You don't need to.
But if you're going to do, for example, a point or period prevalence survey just to kind of get an estimate of the burden of how many patients would be involved in the screening process before you actually institute it as a routine practice, how does that figure into the IRB piece of it?
Again, I wouldn't worry about that, only if you're planning to write it up later and publish it.
What if you don't know that you might do that?
Well, you know, you can, like for chart reviews, for something like that, where you're not keeping protected health information. You know, with the new HIPAA laws, we've got a lot of things going on here too, but protected health information, if you're keeping information about like that, you have to go through a HIPAA board. But when it's basically anonymous data, then I think you're okay. You can go to the IRB later and say that you want to, you know, do this chart review or that you have these data, and that's, I think that's okay. I don't want to turn the balance too much so that you're going to the IRB for everything. I don't want to scare you. I just wanted to kind of bring that up because we have had a couple of cases lately where particularly nurses but also physicians and others have decided that they want to write up something that they've done, you know, like a case series or something, send it into a journal or put it into a national meeting as an abstract, and then they have to withdraw it because they didn't go through the right permissions.
So if you're going to be presenting an abstract, you should go through the IRB for that?
Not always. If it's just a summary of what you're doing for your, you know, regular work, no, I wouldn't say that. It's I'm even getting confused here. But no, I wouldn't say so unless you're actually saying, you know, you had 25 patients with a left ventricular access device where they're more identifiable, then you need to go to an IRB.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, I hope that was helpful. It was probably more confusing than anything.
It was helpful. No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. We have time for, I think, one more question. Dr. Larson, on one of your slides near the end there, on your intention to leave slide, professional practice was identified as a protective factor. Can you identify what that means?
Yeah, it was where they had like a professional practice model where the it's part of what we were talking in the beginning with work processes and work design where nurses had input into decisions about how they manage their daily work and scheduling and how they decide what staff to go where and whether or not they can decide on their own sort of work environment. Those are the kinds of things.
Thanks again to Elaine Larson. Well, it was an outstanding lecture. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I think that having you launch our teleclass schedules each year is a really great idea. You can expect to call again between now and January 2007. Thank you to everyone who is joining this teleclass today. I look forward to meeting all of you again very soon. And until then, goodbye.